This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Coming up this week, an interview with Rob Stewart, director of the movie Sharkwater, and now his latest film, Revolution. Is the ocean dying? What can we do? You can see food prices going up. It's happening around the world, stressing budgets and leading to foodless days for millions of the world's poor. You'll find out why in an international media briefing by Lester Brown of Earth Policy Institute about rising food prices and his new book, Full Planet, Empty Plates. Only on Radio EcoShock. We finish up as Wes Regan of Vancouver tells us about urban farming in the poorest neighborhood in Canada. Lots to tell you about. Let's get going. Rob Stewart blew into world consciousness with his award-winning indie film Sharkwater. As a result of that movie and Stewart's unrelenting campaign, dozens of countries and many more cities have banned shark fin soup, the alleged delicacy wiping out the ocean's top predator. Now Stewart is back for a much bigger fight, the fight of our lives, how to steer a death-wish civilization in a better direction. His new movie, 4 years in the making, was released at the Toronto International Film Festival and again at the Vancouver Film Festival. It's called Revolution. Rob, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Sharkwater was one of the biggest-selling Canadian films ever. It ricocheted all around the world. What are the latest developments in saving the sharks?
Well, the number of countries that have banned shark finning went from 16 when we released Sharkwater to more than 100. There's at least 25 territories that have banned shark fin where you can't even own it. And China has banned shark fin soup at all government functions, which is a significant start in getting shark fin soup banned in China. So I think a lot of good is happening, but you know, there's still a lot more work to be done, for sure.
I just saw your new movie, Revolution. You don't seem like the anarchist type. What kind of revolution are you talking about?
We need to change almost everything about what it is to be a civilized human right now. We're facing a pretty devastating future if we continue business as usual. And I'm sure you know, but you know, by the middle of the century, we face a world with no fish, no reefs, no rainforest, and 9 billion people on a planet that can't even sustain the 7 billion that are here currently. So it's changed, really, conservation. You know, it's not just hugging trees and saving pandas anymore. We've got to save ourselves. And so the revolution we're talking about in the movie is, you know, how are we going to survive this extinction? What do we need to do to turn this around? And, you know, how do we make this planet of ours paradise, not just for us, but for millions of other species?
Okay, well, maybe we should step back a bit. You were touring with Sharkwater, finally made it to China, where shark fins become soup. And yet, in your moment of triumph in Hong Kong, you died a little on stage. Why was that?
At the movie premiere, when we were at the highlight of my life, 120 million people are about to see Sharkwater, and a woman in the audience puts up her hand and says, "Why stop us from eating shark fin soup if, according to the UN, all the fish are going to be gone by 2048? Citing studies done by Boris Worm at Dalhousie University in Halifax, stating that if current fishing trends continue, you could, you know, wipe out all the fisheries. And that sort of launched the journey in this movie, because I've been trying to figure out, you know, what to do next and how to follow up on this. But I'd also met some of these scientists, and what they said was, what you're doing is awesome, but you're missing the point. You know, we're going to lose everything, not just sharks. So it was a pretty great starting point for us and a bit of an insight to me in terms of, you know, what this next movie and what our next sort of mission has to be as a species.
I found myself sort of staring at some of your underwater shots. I wanted to rerun them right there in the theater. They were so amazing. You won my heart with an unlikely hero, the flamboyant cuttlefish. What makes that creature so amazing?
Flamboyant cuttlefish are incredible. They're one of my favorite species in the world. They are cephalopods are 600 million years old, so they've survived 5 major extinctions. But the flamboyant cuttlefish is at the very pinnacle of cephalopod evolution. They're quite recent, and they're the first poisonous cephalopod in the world. And cephalopods, cuttlefish, are related to squids and octopus, and they're really smart. They're smarter than house cats, and they communicate with each other and with other species. They use their bodies as banners for their emotions. So they'll flash colors on the sides of their bodies to talk to other cuttlefish, and they actually use their arms to sign language. And studies, researchers in Australia have recorded 68 distinct hand signals that cuttlefish will make to us when we make a distinct hand signal to them. So they're trying to talk to us, we just don't know what they're saying. And they're gorgeous little bright red and orange and yellow creatures, and yeah, they're amazing.
And slightly poisonous.
Yes, very poisonous.
I'd like to ask you about one claim made in the film. You say coral reefs could be mostly dead in 40 years or less. I've just seen a YouTube lecture by Professor Alexander Tudhope. He's a geoscientist and climatologist from the University of Edinburgh. He seemed less certain about the coral fate, suggesting they could die off, but it's still possible they may adapt enough to survive. Who are the sources you consulted, and what are they telling you about the future of coral?
The sources we went with were a guy named Charlie Varin, who's considered the godfather of coral. He's named at least a quarter of all the world's coral species. Katerina Fabricius, who is the lead scientist at the Australian Institute of Marine Sciences, and Ove Hogelberg, who's another one of Australia's leading coral and acidification scientists. And what they said was a lot of the carbon dioxide we put into the atmosphere gets absorbed by the oceans, making the oceans 30% more acidic than they were 100 years ago. And in a world that is increasing in acidity this fast, animals can't, you know, respond and build skeletons and shells in this world. And sure, the oceans have been more acidic in the past, but we're changing the ocean acidity so quickly that the animals can't possibly evolve to this. And at current trajectories of our emissions, all the coral reefs, well, coral reefs become soluble. They start dissolving at 2070. So coral reefs are sort of succumbing to a triple threat right now. They're getting hit by coral bleaching due to ocean warming, runoff from industry and agriculture and crab thorn starfish, and ocean acidification. And so it's tough to pull any one of those variables out. But the scientists we were talking about think that if current trajectories continue, we'll be, you know, in a world without coral reefs sometime around the middle of the century.
And you had some amazing interviews in the movie. Can you tell us about just a couple of people you met and filmed for Revolution?
Yeah, we met and filmed Boris Worm from Dalhousie University in Halifax, who was responsible for finding out that 90% of the world's large fish are gone and that we could lose all the world's fisheries by the middle of the century if fishing continues. We met Felix Finkbeiner of an organization called Plant for the Planet, who is a 13-year-old who is hell-bent on planting 10 million trees in every country in the world and has, you know, amassed quite a following among youth and adults all around the world. And I also had the opportunity to work with youth delegations and youth groups that are working to fight environmental battles and fight climate issues. And that was probably some of the most inspiring people we met because they don't try to rationalize themselves out of any of the issues. They don't try to, you know, save the environment while retaining economic growth. Or they don't, you know, try to keep the almighty buck ahead of everything else. They just want to get involved and do something and turn this around. And they firmly believe we're going to do it. We're going to do it in this lifetime. And they're, you know, enlisting all their friends and family in it.
Yeah, in the film you suggest only the real victims of fossil fuels will be motivated enough to change the way we live. So you think that young people may be the most likely to save us.
Every revolution in the past, the people that have pushed that revolution were the people most directly impacted by the atrocity. And it's going to be the same in this revolution. You know, young people can imagine the world in 2050 with no fish, no reefs, no rainforest, and want to do something about that. You know, they're going to want to have families, or they're going to imagine their future. And so I really do think that, you know, it's going to be the youth that are taking a stand and stepping up and taking the future back from the adults of today. And many adults, you know, like we are involved in the destruction of our life support systems. You know, we've got cars and we're working for companies that aren't necessarily good for the planet. We've got mortgages. We're in it. But I think the young people, you know, without any of those blocks on their shoulders, can just simply say, oh, we've got to do something about this. Let's take a step forward and make the world a better place.
And when I saw your coverage of activist protests from the UN climate talks in Mexico to Washington, D.C., I started to wonder, are we going to have to arrest our children to keep on polluting? Is that what it's coming to, Rob?
Are we going to have to arrest our children?
Well, yeah. It looks like young people are just being put on the bus and hauled away as they try and tell us how to be more sane.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's part of the problem right now is the way the system is set up, you know, the governments and corporations are often making money off the way things are going. And the way things are going is enormously profitable. I mean, destroying the world we depend on for survival, taking the natural world, packaging it up and selling it to people is enormously profitable. And so one stat we have in the movie is that 51 of the world's 100 biggest economies are corporations. So they're going to be doing battle to try to keep their ecosystem or keep their economic system going. where the young people are going to be, you know, quite opposed to that. So, I mean, it might come down to that sort of generational revolution, but I think it's definitely one where the youth have the power and they've got, you know, life and evolution on their side, where the corporations, you know, they don't have any of that.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is documentary filmmaker and ocean activist Rob Stewart. His new film is called Revolution. In some ways, Rob, you needed the same underground film techniques so successful in Sharkwater. Why do we still need to slink around without permits to document this greatest threat to humanity and maybe all species?
Well, there's a lot of vested interests at stake, for sure. So, you know, when you want to film some of these things, people are going to start questioning, why are you filming it and what are you going to do with just footage and this material? I mean, making Revolution was quite tough. I thought, because Sharkwater had some success, that it would be easy to get our next movie off the ground, but it wasn't. It turned out people were, it seemed, even less interested in saving humans than they were in saving sharks. And, you know, some of the things that we point to in the movie are pretty revolutionary. They're pretty big. I mean, we've got to change a lot, and I think, you know, part of that change is going to even out a bit of the wealth in the world. And so, you know, there's going to be some people against that.
And did that affect your film financing?
It did, yeah. We had $5 million to make this movie. We were shooting it all in 3D. It was going to be, you know, the big, giant vision I had. And then I was spray-painted green, emceeing a big environmental rally in Ottawa, and saying, you know, it was called Fill the Hill Sea Day, or Power Shift. And I was saying, you know, we don't just need Priuses and recycling. We need a revolution. We've got to change everything. And then all of our money fell away. And we went from having $5 million to having $150,000 overnight, because of how radical the movie became. And so it was a major, major setback, and part of the reason why Revolution took 4 years to make was we had to do it in a guerrilla fashion. But it also, you know, re-strengthened my resolve and got us, you know, pitted up against, you know, and to do the battle we kind of need to do.
And talk to us just a little bit about your relationship with another ocean defender. He's currently on the run, even though I think he should be rewarded by society, and that's Captain Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd Society.
Paul's one of my heroes. We worked together in creating Sharkwater, and it was Paul, you know, colliding with a Guatemalan fishing boat and us getting charged with attempted murder that really, you know, gave Sharkwater that crazy story. But because of that incident that happened in 2002, Costa Rica reissued arrest warrants for Paul, and he was arrested in Germany earlier this year and is now an international fugitive because Costa Rica wants to bring him back to Costa Rica to face trial, where he will, you know, undoubtedly probably not face a fair trial due to the shark fin industry in Costa Rica. So I think Paul's an absolute hero. And I think, you know, what could come of this, you know, if he can't hit, you know, if he can't come into port, then he becomes the vigilante renegade eco-hero that we all want him to be.
He's still out there at sea, and I hope he's doing well. Rob Stewart, what tipped your journey from a self-described nerd with a camera to such an activist stance, even a revolutionary?
I think it's just the knowledge. I mean, I would happily go back to my life as a wildlife photographer taking pictures of fish, but I know a lot more now, and with that knowledge, I can't do anything but educate people and try to get everybody to know what we're doing and where we're going and how to get out of it. I mean, I think this is the biggest issue humanity's ever faced, and possibly the biggest issue any species has ever faced. And, you know, it's going to take a lot of us, all of us, coming together to figure out how to do this and to turn this around, because we're, in a way, going up against the biggest corporations and governments in the world, but we're fighting for all the ecosystems and species in the world. And so, you know, I think we've got a massive opportunity in this to step it up as a species and learn what it is to be human and work together and put other things ahead of profits. And I think that, you know, all this is probable and possible within our lifetimes, and that the young people particularly can see a future where we figure this out and we fix the design flaws of this pre-revolutionary civilization. And we live in a world that's paradise on Earth, not just for us, but for millions of other species.
Yeah, you'd think even the possibility of something like mass extinction would get people's attention, but it seemed the Kardashians get more print. Do you think it's too extreme to describe ourselves as living in a death culture?
Oof. Yeah, I would. but, I mean, it's all a matter of perspective, whatever you take on it. I mean, I don't think we live in that culture at all. I think we set up a system on this planet, a system of economy, a system of corporations, a system of government, when we had infinite space and infinite resources. You know, so when there were a few hundred million people on Earth, we could do whatever we want. But now that there's 7 billion of us, we're running up against significant barriers. And that model we created a thousand years ago just isn't effective. So I don't think we live in a death culture by any means. I think we live in a beautiful culture where, you know, people are connected and they're sharing stories and sharing insight and wisdom, and we're learning and we're growing and evolving. I just think if everybody knew what was actually happening, if everybody knew that our consumption patterns, our governments, our corporations were running amok and destroying our life support system, they would take radically different decisions, elect different officials, support different corporations, and their emotions would guide them to making better decisions. They would feel bad about things that were destructive for the environment and good about things that were good for the planet. And I think, you know, once we let our emotions guide us, then we'll be on the right path. So I really do think we live in a pretty beautiful world that's full of immense possibilities, and we are going to turn this around.
You just published a book as well. Tell us a little bit about Save the Humans.
Save the Humans is sort of part autobiography, part backstory of Sharkwater and Revolution. Making movies is enormously difficult, and what goes in to the other side of it is definitely as dramatic as what happens in the movies. And I thought if I could bring people on the journey that I went on as a young fish nerd, falling in love with the ocean, figuring out it's in jeopardy and trying to do something about it, and arriving at this position of hope where I'm at now, that people would come along on that journey and then come to the same conclusions that I have, that we're in a really serious predicament. We've got to turn this around. We're going to do it. And so I was hoping by writing a book, Save the Humans, that I could impart a little bit of that journey and, you know, paint a bright picture of where we could go. Because I think instead of trying to be adversarial in all this and trying to, you know, fight against corporations and against governments and try to stop these environmental disasters from happening, if we start focusing on what if we got this right, what if we made Earth paradise for us and millions of other species, what if we went to the rivers and the lakes for fish and the oceans for fish instead of salmon farms, what if we ate locally, what if we had green roofs everywhere, what if our economy was focused on sustainability and ecosystem restoration. I mean, I think this could be a beautiful world we live in. And so I'm trying to bring people that story.
And it's a good story. And I know you're working insane hours to get your message out, and you're calling for help with a new environment group, the United Conservationists. What is that?
United Conservationists is our way to help show people how to change the world. Well, what we realized in making Sharkwater is that changing the world isn't that hard. It's just we haven't tried yet. And the amount of countries that have banned shark fin soup rose dramatically, and a lot of it was led by kids. So we started this little charity, United Conservationists, to try to show people how to change the world the way they want to change the world, and to, you know, make them sort of part of a bigger community of conservationists that are united to, you know, to make the world a better place.
How will folks get to see your new movie, Revolution?
Revolution hits theaters across Canada Earth Day 2013 in April.
So it's going to be out on the big screens and then eventually go to DVD, is that the plan?
Yep, out on DVD, you know, within a year after it's out in theaters, and then it'll eventually be on the internet to download as well.
Well, listeners, I've got links to Rob's work in my show blog at ecoshock.info. You can find the film website at therevolutionmovie.com and try unitedconservationists.org. Rob Stewart, I loved the movie. It's deep and necessary. I hope it storms the world. Thank you for spending time with Radio EcoShock listeners.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Hey, this is Alex. I've got Lester Brown coming up in an exclusive press briefing about the world food situation, plus Wes Regan on localizing food right here in Vancouver's downtown East Side. You are about to hear Lester Brown, founder of the Earth Policy Institute, on his new book, Full Planet, Empty Plates: The New Geopolitics of Food Scarcity. This presentation for the media was recorded on September 27th, 2012. Lester is introduced by Kaylee Crater.
It's really my honor today to introduce Lester Brown, who's been described as one of the world's most influential thinkers by the Washington Post. He is the founder and president of the Earth Policy Institute, a nonprofit environmental research organization based in Washington, D.C. During a career that started with tomato farming, Lester Brown has been awarded 25 honorary degrees and has authored or co-authored 50 books. He's one of the world's most widely published authors, and his books have appeared in 40 languages. The book you're going to hear about today is entitled Full Planet, Empty Plates, The New Geopolitics of Food Scarcity. He is a MacArthur Fellow, and in 1985, the Library of Congress requested his personal papers, noting that his writings and work had already strongly affected thinking about the problems of world population and resources. So, Lester, please go ahead and tell us more about your book.
Thanks, Kaylee. The thesis of Full Planet, Empty Plates is that the world is in a transition from an age dominated by surpluses, that was basically the last half of the last century, to one that's increasingly going to be dominated by scarcity. This year, we had a near-record all-time drought in the United States, one that led to a reduction in the world grain harvest of 73 million tons. To put that in perspective, that's roughly equal to the grain harvest of Canada and Australia combined. So it was not a trivial loss. And it's left the world in a situation of rising prices for both corn and soybeans. Food prices are rising worldwide. Those of us in this country aren't affected that much when the price of wheat doubles because we are insulated by all the processing that takes place between the wheat that leaves the farm and the wheat in the bread when it reaches our table. Beyond that, we only spend 10% of our income on food anyhow, so it doesn't have a huge effect on us. But in some parts of the world where people spend 50 to 70% of their income on food and the price of wheat doubles, they're in trouble. And we're seeing this not only lead to a cutback in consumption and then going to one meal a day, which is what's typically happened in the past when things got tight, but there are a growing number of families now that are scheduling foodless days when they will not actually eat anything. A survey by Save the Children shows that in India, 24% of all families now routinely schedule foodless days. They may decide at the beginning of the week they won't eat on Wednesday and Saturday, for example. In Nigeria, 27% of families now plan foodless days. In Peru, it's 14%. So this is sort of a new step in human deprivation in terms of food consumption. And it's a worrying one because it's affecting such large numbers of people. When we go back and look back over the last several years, we see that in 2007, 2008, we had a doubling of world grain prices. At that time, exporters began to restrict exports. Russia and Argentina for wheat, for example, Vietnam, the world's leading rice exporter. And then importing countries panicked because they suddenly realized they could not rely on the market to get the food they need. That translated into the land rush. Countries buying land, importing countries buying land in other countries on which to produce food for themselves. These land grabs, as of a year or so ago, totaled at least 160 million acres. That's equal to the wheat and corn area combined in the United States. So it's not a trivial amount of land at stake here. But food prices have not returned to the norm. We now see, and I mentioned this in the book, food is becoming the new oil. The competition for access to food is becoming intense in many cases. And land is the new gold. Investing in land has been a good bet now for the last several years. In fact, land prices are going up about twice as fast as the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Why suddenly is all this happening? Why are we running into so much trouble on the food front? Well, on the demand side, we're seeing record growth in the demand for grain. Some of it's population growth. We're adding 80 million people a year. That's not new. We've been doing that for the last few decades. 219,000 people will be at the dinner table tonight who were not there last night. And this adds up. Population growth adds up to relentless mounting pressure on the earth's land and water resources. Then we had this great idea in the United States of using grain to produce fuel for cars. And because of that, last year we harvested about 400 million tons of grain, and 129 million tons went to ethanol distilleries. In this country, we are now using more corn to fuel cars than we are to feed livestock and poultry. So it is squeezing food supplies in this country, and therefore, because we're such a major exporter, it's affecting the entire world. The third thing, after population growth and using grain to fuel cars, is rising affluence. We can best understand this by looking at grain consumption in a low-income society and in a high-income society. In India, annual grain consumption is about 400 pounds, or about a pound a day. When you have only a pound of grain a day, you consume almost all of that directly just to keep body and soul together. You can't afford to convert much of it into animal protein. In the United States, we use about 1,600 pounds of grain per year. Of that, we consume maybe 200 pounds directly as bread and breakfast cereals and so forth. But the bulk of that is converted into animal protein, into meat, milk, and eggs. What we are now seeing in the world is roughly 3 billion people trying to move up the food chain, consuming more grain-intensive livestock products. We see this most dramatically in China, where China's meat consumption, which, say, 15 years ago was less than that of the United States, has now doubled that of the United States. And it is this huge number of people moving up the food chain, consuming more grain-intensive, i.e. corn-intensive livestock products, that has made corn the world's leading grain. Historically, it was the big three grains, wheat, rice, and corn. Wheat and rice are food grains. Corn is a feed grain, but corn is now by far the leader at about 900 million tons, a third larger than wheat and nearly double the world rice harvest. So we have demand growing at a record rate, and over the last decade, the annual growth in world demand for grain has jumped from 21 million tons a year to 41 million tons a year. So now the world's farmers are scrambling to come up with another 41 million tons per year of grain production. And that's against a world production base of about 2 billion tons of grain a year. On the supply side, we have four factors now that are making it more difficult to expand production. One is water shortages. Half the world's people live in countries where water tables are falling as a result of overpumping, mostly for irrigation. In the Arab Middle East, this would include Yemen, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Iraq, Jordan. In those countries, water shortages, falling water tables, irrigation wells going dry are leading to a shrinkage of the grain harvest in that region. So for the first time, we have sort of a sub-region of the world, namely the Arab Middle East, where grain production is falling because of water shortages. There are also water shortages in the big three grain producers. The World Bank estimates that 175 million people in India are being fed with grain produced by overpumping. My estimate for China is that 120 million Chinese are now being fed with grain produced by overpumping. Overpumping is by definition a short-term phenomenon. You can't overpump forever because eventually the aquifers go dry, the wells go dry, and then the rate of pumping is necessarily limited by the rate of aquifer recharge. In the U.S., we see leading agricultural states like Texas and California with shrinking irrigated area. They've probably each lost 15%, maybe 20% of their irrigated area over the last decade or two. And these are our two big agricultural states. They're losing irrigation water, both because of aquifer depletion and also because more and more irrigation water is being diverted to cities. So water shortages are a big factor influencing our capacity to expand production in the future. The second factor is climate change. There's a rule of thumb that for each 1 degree Celsius rise in temperature above the norm during the growing season, we can expect a 10% decline in grain yields. It now turns out that, if anything, that rule of thumb is conservative. The drop in harvest as a result of a 1 degree Celsius rise in temperature may be greater than 10%. Photosynthesis is affected by temperature. From 68 degrees to 95 degrees, photosynthesis is very stable. But once temperature goes above 95 degrees, photosynthesis begins to decline. When you hit 104 degrees, there's no photosynthesis at all. At that point, the plant goes into thermal shock. There's no growth. It's just surviving. One of the interesting questions that we now face in this country is, was this year's drought a one-time thing? Is it going to stand alone in the historical trend? Or is it a manifestation of climate change, and may we see several consecutive years of drought in the future? We don't know. It makes you a little queasy just to think about the possibility of droughts like the one we had this year being strung together in consecutive years. Agriculture, as we know it today, has evolved over an 11,000-year period of rather remarkable climate stability. Agriculture, as it exists today, has evolved to maximize production with that climate system. But that climate system is no more. And now, with each passing year, the agricultural system and the climate system are more and more out of sync with each other. And that's going to take a toll on harvests in many countries around the world from year to year, with the toll likely growing larger. So we have water shortages and we have climate change. We also have soil erosion. We've been overplowing and overgrazing in recent decades to the point where there are now two massive new dust bowls forming, one in northwestern China and western Mongolia, the other in central Africa. Dust bowls are not new. We had a dust bowl in the 1930s, but we were able to get it under control by taking some of the more vulnerable land out of production, putting it back in grass, by strip cropping, by planting tree windbreaks. So our dust bowl was short-lived, just for a matter of years during the 1930s. Then the Russians had a dust bowl the Soviets in the late 50s and early 60s. They overplowed, and much of that overplowing was in what is now Kazakhstan. They pulled back, and that situation stabilized. In some countries in the world, soil erosion has reached the point where it is reducing harvests. This is true in Mongolia and Lesotho, for example. In both countries, grain production is falling as the soil blows away. In Haiti, production is not falling, but grain production is not increasing either. And that's because soil erosion is occurring on a scale there that enables it to offset any advances in technology or investments in agriculture. So in addition to water shortages, climate change, and soil erosion, we now have a new constraint on world grain production. It's what I call the glass ceiling on grain yields. For the last half century or more, all the agriculturally advanced countries have been raising their wheat yield per acre, their rice yield per acre, their corn yield per acre. And now suddenly, in recent years, some of the more agriculturally advanced countries have sort of hit this glass ceiling and they can no longer raise their yields. Japan and South Korea both hit the ceiling with rice yields, Japan about 15 years ago and South Korea not too long after that. But they've not raised yields at all over this past decade or so. We have a similar situation in Europe, where wheat yields have plateaued in France, Germany, and the UK. These are the three leading wheat producers in Western Europe. Wheat yields have not increased for at least a decade there. And it's not that wheat farmers in France don't want to keep raising yields. It's just that there are no technologies now to take them any further. So this glass ceiling, I call it a glass ceiling because we didn't know exactly where it was. We knew we couldn't raise yields forever, but now we're seeing where the limits are. We have a lot of factors on the demand side that are expanding demand for grain worldwide at a record rate, double the rate of a decade ago. On the supply side, we have these new constraints, emerging water shortages, climate change, soil erosion, and the discovery of this glass ceiling on yields in the more agriculturally advanced countries. These make it more difficult to eradicate hunger, to respond to the concept of foodless days that we now see popping up in so many developing countries. If I were to pick one economic indicator that I think will tell us more than any other about our future, it would be the price of food. The price of food, I think, will tell us more about the future of civilization than any other single indicator. The question then is, what do we do? How do we deal with this threat of tightening food supplies and continually rising food prices? Well, one of the things we can do is raise water productivity. It is water, not land, that is now restricting the growth in world food production. There's a lot of land in the world that would produce food if there was enough water to go with it. So raising water productivity becomes a major goal. It should be similar to the one we adopted beginning in the 1950s, when we realized that world population was going to double by the end of the century. And we also realized that even then, there wasn't much new land to plow. So we had to raise land productivity. So we did a number of things: international research cooperation, production incentives for farmers, and we ended up doubling world grain yields between 1950 and 2010. We tripled grain land productivity. We now need to think about how to do something like that with water. So number one on the what-to-do list, raise water productivity. Number two, we need to rebuild grain reserves. The guide for adequate grain reserves that was set by FAO probably 30, 40 years ago was that carryover grain stocks, that is the amount in the bin just as the new harvest begins, should be at least 70 days of consumption. At the end of this year, they're going to be below 70 days. We don't know how much yet. But at a time when we're facing climate change and the instability of extreme weather events, whether it's droughts or floods or fires or whatever, I think we need a lot more than 70 days. I think we need 110 days of carryover stocks to ensure future food price stability. So the second thing, I think we need to rebuild world grain reserves. The third thing we need to do is to stabilize climate, and that means cutting carbon emissions fast. In our Plan B, for what we need to do about these problems in the world, the book Plan B, we talk about cutting carbon emissions, the need to cut carbon emissions, 80% within the next decade. Not by 2050, which is what political leaders like to talk about. We don't use 2050 because we think the game will be over long before then. But it does mean that if we cut carbon emissions 80% in the next decade, it's going to take something like a World War II mobilization to do that. It's doable. It's entirely doable. We have the technologies now to do it. But we don't yet have the policy commitments on a scale to make that possible. The other thing we need to do is stabilize population. And that means eradicating poverty. As economist Jeffrey Sachs has pointed out, for the first time in history, we have the resources to eradicate poverty in the world. The exciting thing about doing that is that it's the key to stabilizing population. The two principal components of an effort to stabilize world population well before we reach the projected 9 billion is, one, make sure that women everywhere have access to family planning service. There are millions of women who want to plan their families but do not have access to family planning services. The amount of expenditure to fill that family planning gap is so small it would get lost in the rounding of the U.S. defense budget. But it is a major threat to future food security for people throughout the world. So we know what needs to be done. Raise water productivity, build up grain reserves, dramatically cut carbon emissions, and stabilize population as soon as possible. We know what to do, but we're not doing a very good job on any one of those four counts. And interestingly, two of them fall within the responsibility of ministries of agriculture: raising water productivity, because 80% of all the water we use in the world is for irrigation, and rebuilding grain reserves. The other two big things, cutting carbon emissions and stabilizing population, lie with the Ministry of Energy and with the Ministry of Health and Family Planning. They are outside agriculture, but they are important to the solution of the problem to the eradication of hunger.
That was Lester Brown, founder of the Earth Policy Institute. He was speaking about his new book, Full Planet, Empty Plates: The New Geopolitics of Food Scarcity. This presentation for the media was recorded on September 27th, 2012.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
There are mysterious gardens appearing in Canada's poorest urban neighborhood, Vancouver's downtown East Side. And why is a business group pushing local food? Our guest is Wes Regan, executive coordinator of the Hastings Crossing Business Improvement Association in Vancouver, Canada. Wes toured internationally as an actor and musician before becoming an urban geographer. He's a founding member of the Vancouver Urban Farming Network and the Urban Aquafarm Society. Wes, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex.
I'd like to start with a little patch of vacant land I've seen in an area known for poverty and drug abuse. It's squeezed between two old buildings, this lot on Hastings Street. It used to be covered in garbage. Now it's got food on it. Can you tell us about that urban garden?
Yeah, there's a couple of them on Hastings Street. There's three. One of them is growing commercially. That one's further down near the Astoria, and that's a soul food plot. One of them is the Insight Community Garden, which is akin to horticultural therapy, really, and that's there for some of the residents in the area who use Insight. And the third one, which is right across from Save on Meats, is a project that's been put together by the Portland Hotel Society, and they're growing food there for their meal program in some of the SROs and some of the other social housing that they manage there in the neighborhood. So three different growing spaces and three different reasons or three different mandates behind those spaces as well.
Well, our American audience wouldn't know what Insight is, and they wouldn't know what SROs are, so why don't you expand on that?
Well, Insight is the first safe injection site for intravenous drug users in North America. It follows the European model of harm reduction. The philosophy is that by having a safe place to discard of needles or having a safe place to inject where someone can supervise you, the risk of either sharing needles and transmitting a bloodborne pathogen or overdosing from poor quality drugs or too much of a dose is mitigated, and therefore the public health concerns around addiction in that part of the city are over the long term improved, and over the short term too, could be argued. SROs, single room occupancy, and those are essentially, you know, they're hotel rooms basically, but oftentimes they lack amenities, even basic amenities such as bathrooms. So they'll have a small space with barely any room for cooking your own food or even a refrigerator, and they'll be shared bathrooms. A lot of them are in pretty poor condition, and food security in Vancouver's downtown east side, similar to other cities around North America, is obviously a major concern. It's a food desert, or in some places can be considered a food swamp, in which there's just nothing but junk food, essentially. So growing food in these gardens, especially food that can be accessed while it's still fresh, doesn't need to be refrigerated or prepared, really. Those are good options for people that really don't have a lot of, you know, cooking technology, so to speak.
Well, as you're saying, some downtown Eastside residents have seen their share of problems, along with the newly arriving condo owners. There's a mix of alcoholics, drug addicts, the disabled, the unemployed, people who've been disadvantaged or even abused. Some are First Nations people. Do you find many willing gardeners, and what is the personal impact for them of having a space to grow?
Yeah, I think one of the most powerful examples of the social or cultural benefits of growing food is really soul food. That's a great project in particular. That I think they now have four or five sites in the downtown east side. And for them, it was seen not only as a way to improve food security in the area, but also a way to create, I guess, what we could call culturally appropriate jobs, which are jobs that are attainable for residents with barriers to employment that might not be able to work in a, you know, high-end cafe as a barista or something like that. But they can still enjoy getting their hands in the dirt, planting and tending to those vegetables or bringing them to market and stuff like that. So, and not, you know, not on 9 to 5 hours. Like, it's a more flexible sort of a human resources model, if you will, where they can work the amount that they can work when they can work, and soul food finds a way to accommodate all those residents that meet them, just meet them where they are in their lives, meet them halfway. So, yeah, I think there are a lot of residents in the downtown east side who are eager to see better food in the community and are also eager to see opportunities for employment, you know, to add a little extra income. Recently, the government softened some of their policies or laws around clawbacks on welfare. So residents are actually able to make a few hundred more dollars a month now. I think it's at least $200 extra in cash. It might even be as high as eight, I think, you know. I mean, that's a step in the right direction. But now we need the types of jobs that, you know, residents that have encountered those difficulties in their lives, you know, are able to feasibly take on. So urban agriculture and a couple of other green-collar jobs were identified a few years ago as good areas to be looking into in regards to that.
Well, I want to ask a question on behalf of all the urban and really the suburban people. Don't hungry people, drunks and vandals just steal the food or wreck the gardens?
No, actually, I haven't heard of any cases of that happening. And I think it's partly because there's a strong sense of community ownership over those spaces or those places. There's less stigmatization around that part of the city. And I think just inner cities in general throughout North America as places where lawless and self-interested people with no morals are just kind of wandering around looking for the next fix and stuff like that.
No. That's Wall Street you're talking about.
Yeah. That's true. But it's incredible just how much social capital actually exists in these low-income communities. These people that have learned how to struggle together. And when a community, you know, whether they're a high-income community or a low-income community, learns how to struggle together, that creates a lot of trust and it creates a lot of genuine dialogue about the human condition in general. And so there's a lot of, you know, respect in the neighborhood. There's respect for murals, you know, graffiti murals have been put up. There's respect for little renegade gardens or just little renegade placemaking features that have not been city sanctioned. It's just the community's way of placemaking, if you will. And so these gardens have, to the best of my knowledge, never had an incidence of vandalism or theft. And oftentimes people will walk by, particularly the Soul Food spot, which is near the Astoria Hotel, they'll walk by and they'll lean up on the fence and they'll start talking to the farmers and asking them about the food. And Sean Dory, the coordinator there at Soul Food, has tons of stories of people just randomly popping by and getting in a conversation about food and sustainability and the community and gentrification and just another example of the social and cultural binding ability of food growing and food eating, for that matter.
And too often, we think of business as being hostile to green initiatives, but you coordinate the local business improvement association. How did that unlikely marriage come about?
I was working for a community economic development agency 2009-2010, and a green collar job creation, I think as I alluded to earlier, was identified as one of those areas where we could see a lot of entrepreneurial growth and a lot of job growth. And just serving a variety of needs, whether it's retrofitting buildings, putting in, you know, elastomeric white roofs or green roofs, and looking at things like urban agriculture, waste diversion, remanufacturing, all those sorts of things. And we have a strong green cluster already in the downtown east side. It's mostly centered in Strathcona. But when I transferred over from that agency, I had been helping a group of businesses, a lot of them very socially progressive and environmentally responsible businesses, to form this BIA. And the philosophy behind it was that if businesses that didn't have a more compassionate or empathic approach to their role in the community would do this, then some other businesses that didn't have quite as altruistic goals would come by and do it, and that would probably just increase the pace of gentrification and displacement and cause more tension in the community. So they asked me if I wanted to sort of segue over from my role with building opportunities with business when my contract finished there. And I thought, yeah, I think this is a great opportunity to try and form a business improvement area and really do it differently. I think we're really trying something unique. We'd like to call ourselves the Social Innovation BIA. The trick is to bring value for money to our stakeholders, which are the businesses and property owners. But in so doing that, we're trying to connect that to more community capacity building opportunities, job creation for residents, and any sort of sustainability improvements in the neighborhood, both environmentally, culturally, and socially and economically. So the whole picture, we're looking for broad net positive gains for multiple stakeholders, not just the businesses and properties, but that's where we start.
Wes, please tell us a little bit about the Vancouver Urban Farming Network.
Yeah, in 2010, it was October. Part of that research into looking into those green-collar job areas that we were looking to create jobs through. We identified several people that were farming, and we decided to do some research into who was doing what, how much they were growing, you know, what really were the job creation opportunities there. And so the more and more that we kept on getting together, the more it kind of turned into an informal network. And so we started having events where we'd be sharing information about what the various farmers were doing, what was working, what wasn't, sort of best practices and stuff. And we were identifying gaps in policy or land use and planning areas where we thought that the city could be engaged by the farmers in order to create a better environment, a regulatory and policy environment for urban farming to grow here. And so we held a forum in November of 2011, and the findings from that forum have helped inform the city of the types of policies and types of regulations that would enable urban farming. And the farmers themselves have continued to come together, and we've collectively formed the Vancouver Urban Farming Society now, which is the official society that we come around in order to continue that advocacy work and that capacity building work in the urban farming sector. There's about 23 farms now, most of them growing for commercial purposes, but some of them for social justice or, you know, just neighborhood community purposes. But most of them are commercial, and a lot of them are very highly educated and experienced people. So it's a really fun, really smart group to be working with, and it's been incredible to see it just continue to grow.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith, talking with Wes Regan, urban farmer and executive coordinator of the Business Improvement Association in Vancouver's poorest neighborhood called the Downtown East Side. Wes Regan, you're also part of the Urban Aquafarm Society. Are there really aquaculture operations in the city of Vancouver?
That's a tricky one. The yard conversions, you know, growing vegetables in the front yards and backyards, and you know, anything that's not involving animal husbandry is generally a lot easier to get up and running here in town. There are a few groups. There's a consortium that's working up at UBC that's bringing together, you know, not just aquaponics, but also closed containment aquaculture advocates from around the province. And there was a group, Backyard Bounty, that had a few aquaponics setups in town here. Britannia Elementary School was one site where they had one of their demonstration projects, and they got a couple of backyard barrelponics setups throughout the city. But we think that Urban Stream, which is the company that I'm a partner in, once we get one of our units up and running, it's going to be, I think, the first example of a true commercial-scale aquaponics operation here in Vancouver, similar to, you know, Will Allen's aquaponics setups there out in Wisconsin.
And how do you picture aquafarms contributing to the cities of the future?
Well, currently there's a protein deficit for the urban areas in regards to urban farming. The farms, like I said earlier, you know, it's great. There's a lot of leafy greens. Because land values are generally high, or because you generally don't have a lot of space to work with, a lot of the farmers will grow high-end microgreens, baby greens, and specialty items. So, you know, there is a unfortunate trend in some cases towards those items and not so much staples. But I don't think the farmers themselves even would delude ourselves that we're going to grow all the food that a city needs here in the urban environment, at least not with current practices and technologies. That's definitely a ways off. You know, there's projects like Dixon DePalmier's vertical farm project. He's out of Columbia University there in New York. And they have these crazy utopian technological futurists, you know, charrettes of huge skyscrapers that are growing food and have like mini contained ecosystems and stuff like that. And those are obviously massively capital intensive, billions of dollars going into that. And it's just not likely, especially with today's economic climate, that that's going to be the path forward, I don't think. Maybe down the road a ways. So in the case of Urban Stream, we use more of an aggregate strategy where we have shipping containers that are placed throughout the city that are almost operating at a district scale, not a citywide scale. So we're looking at a more diffuse approach to creating food sort of neighborhood by neighborhood. And I think that there's a place for aquaponics in that matrix, if you will, because protein is really, I think, one of those key areas where cities and food security are not going to be adequately met. The dietary needs are not going to be met if we don't have protein in there. So aquaponics is just one of those areas where I think it's a natural, possibly even makes more sense than chickens and larger, you know, livestock and stuff. I think it actually makes a lot of sense in that regard. I don't have a lot to do with the community gardens. There's a pretty big, clear distinction between the urban farmers who are growing for predominantly commercial reasons and the urban community garden plots.
You and I know Vancouver Mayor Gregor Robinson and his council are supportive. They want to make Vancouver the greenest city in the world. But how could we make this same case to less sympathetic municipal governments?
I think in the end boils down to the cost-benefit analysis for them, because I don't think you can appeal to particularly the conservative governments on a emotional or even perhaps even a moral basis for why we need to make a transition to a more sustainable urban food system and be looking at these sort of things. But I think if you approach it on a cost-benefit analysis and you demonstrate how cities in the long run are actually going to be more fiscally responsible if they're reducing the cost associated with the externalities of an unsustainable food system or an unsustainable urban framework, period, then hopefully, no matter what your ideological leanings, the numbers will make sense and cities will start to make that transition. And so the goal for Vancouver, I think, has been and will continue to be to clearly quantify those positive impacts or those positive externalities that are created by these policy changes and by these initiatives.
And also, as you say, it helps to bring back some people who have been kind of, I wouldn't say outsourced, but just shut out of society by creating these green-collar jobs and getting things reintegrated. It's got to be good for the community.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the economy has seen such sweeping transitions in the past 30 years away from manufacturing to services and now to really the creative sector or lifestyle economy. And so in that transition, I mean, that's a really short period of time where we've seen a huge shift in the nature of work in cities. And so we have a lot of cities where I think men, middle-aged men in particular, are caught kind of between a rock and a hard place. And it's really a lot of those middle-aged men, that not men in particular, but people that have been caught, you know, in this transition. And they've been, I think, further alienated by not being able to keep up, you know, not being able to get the training in order to work in the high-tech sector or the creative sector, or lacking the sort of cultural awareness or the lack of even language, you know, that helps them to integrate through those changes. There's only so much tertiary consumer goods that a city can create before it reaches a point where you have diminishing returns culturally and economically on the output of that area. And so looking back to the essentials, looking at food, looking at shelter, looking at even transportation and distribution throughout the urban environment, those are sort of basic bread and butter jobs that keep a city functioning smoothly. And I think that there's a lot of job creation opportunity there, tons of job creation opportunity around food, around better dealing with our waste, whether it's recyclables or whether it's things like deconstruction, whether it is organic food scraps and how we can tap into the, you know, the reusable outputs of that. And so, yeah, I think that all in all, you know, this is a transition, I would hope, to an economy that's more inclusive, because it's offering more opportunities for a more diverse labor pool to engage in meaningful work that's going to make the community better. Yeah, definitely. I think there's a great opportunity to engage residents of our communities who have been shut out of the labor market because of the changing nature of work. I think we're seeing it change again, only this time it's going to be more inclusive and more inviting.
Well, I'll put some links to some of the things we've been talking about in my show blog at ecoshock.info, but can you give us a couple of web, Twitter, or Facebook places for our listeners to follow up?
Yeah, if they're interested in a little bit more about what's going on with the urban farming movement here in Vancouver, urbanfarmers.ca is a website they can head to. And if they are curious about what is going on in the inner city in regards to local economic development, some of the projects that Hastings Crossing BIA is involved in, hxbia.com. And they can follow the Hastings Crossing Twitter account at hxbia as well.
We've been talking with Wes Regan, Executive Coordinator of Hastings Crossing Business Improvement Association in downtown Vancouver, Canada. Wes, thank you so much for helping us out.
Thanks, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. Find us on Facebook, and you can share each and every program with your friends. We need to get the word out fast to save what is left of the natural system. You can help. Feel free to download our show from the website, ecoshock.org. Pass them around as free MP3s or CDs. I'm Alex Smith. I appreciate your helpful emails, tips, and links sent in by listeners too. Radio@ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.